I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Federal Reserve injected billions of dollars into worldwide financial markets today in an effort to ease credit in the face of what's being called the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. By now, you can repeat the litany of woes with me. Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy protection, Bank of America bailed out Merrill Lynch, and then the federal government bailed out AIG. Well, President Bush made 2 minutes of remarks on the financial debacle today, his first comments since the crisis began on Monday. He said the administration will continue to act to stabilize the financial markets. And both presidential campaigns have new outs out as well. Here's an excerpt from Senator Obama's.
Here's what I believe we need to do. Reform our tax system to give a $1,000 tax break to the middle class instead of showering more on oil companies and corporations that outsource our jobs. End the anything-goes culture on Wall Street with real regulation that protects your
And here's a portion from John McCain's.
You, the American workers, are the best in the world, but your economic security has been put at risk by the greed of Wall Street. That's unacceptable. My opponent's only solutions are talk and taxes. I'll reform Wall Street and fix Washington.
So, how would the candidates handle the crisis, and what are their broader economic plans? Let's get right to our conversation today. It's with David Leonhardt, columnist for The New York Times. David, welcome.
It's good to be here.
And first to the crisis on Wall Street. As it broke earlier in the week, John McCain first said the economy was strong. He came back later that morning and said he meant to say that American workers were strong. But what kind of tone has each candidate had since that might indicate to you where they stand on where we go from here?
I think if we were just judging them based on what they're saying on the campaign right now, we would have to conclude that they are very similar. I think if you look at their records, if you look at their history, if you look at their proposals as opposed to their speeches, you would not conclude that they are very similar. They're similar in that they're both talking about, we need to stop this, the government needs to stop this, we can't let this happen again. Obama tends to talk more specifically about regulation. McCain talks a little bit more about reform. He talks about greed. He talks about, we're not going to let CEOs keep doing this. McCain's top domestic policy advisor has said this week, this isn't the time for specifics. And so it's a little bit hard to know what exactly McCain would change.
I'm going to jump in there. Douglas Holtz-Eakin did come out and say that McCain might be for some more regulation at one point. But your point is taken. Obama has used the word regulation, calling for investment banks, mortgage brokers, hedge funds to be regulated the way commercial banks already are. And just to remind our listeners, you know, right now, bad loans are supposed to be flagged at commercial banks, and Obama's suggesting that same oversight would be applied to other institutions. And Joe Biden, his running mate, made the point this week that now that these companies are in effect federally backed, you know, they've been rescued, that their books should be open as well. I mean, is this a tougher conversation for John McCain? Because in the past, he's been against regulation.
That's right. It is a tougher conversation. I mean, there are a number of John McCains when you talk about the economy. Throughout the 1980s and into the early 90s, McCain was a fairly reliable conservative on a lot of these economic issues, taxes, regulation. Then he loses the 2000 primary to George Bush, and as has been well documented, he has this period afterwards in which he clearly moves to the left. I mean, he becomes essentially a centrist Democrat. He's for more regulation. He's against Bush's tax cuts as being too expensive. Then, starting in 2004 or so, he moves back to the right. And so in terms of policy prescriptions, tax cuts, regulation, he looks very much like a traditional conservative. In terms of the rhetoric, he's moving back toward the way he was in say, 2001 today. It's just really hard to know how he would be as president, though, because we have a history that points to him being a fairly middle-of-the-road, typical deregulatory Republican, and we have his words today, which point in another direction. But we don't have proposals to evaluate.
Well, and there is one proposal we just throw in, that he has proposed a commission, like a 9/11 commission, to study everything that's going on.
That's right, which is a proposal without a lot of substance to it. I'm not saying it's a bad idea, but you can't say here are the upsides of a commission and here are the downsides. The commission is something that later on will report.
What about Barack Obama? In a recent article in the Sunday New York Times magazine, you wrote that many see Obama as a University of Chicago Democrat. In other words, one that believes in free markets, laissez-faire economics, and he's also spoken positively about Reagan and Reagan Democrats. So is there a little bit of shifting more towards regulation from him as well?
I keep in mind with Obama is that he is more comfortable with how markets work than a lot of Democrats. But that isn't what's likely to dominate the agenda of an Obama administration, if there is one. In that same article, I quoted Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary, who is an advisor to Obama, saying, the problems we have today are not so much the problems that markets can solve. We've actually gotten pretty good at the issues that markets can solve. The problems we have today are problems like inequality, education, investment, oversight, to bring it back to Wall Street, that markets aren't so good at solving. And so while in many instances Obama is more comfortable with the way the market works than a lot of Democrats, he's still very much a Democrat, and Democrats would overwhelmingly argue that a lot of the problems we have today are problems that stemmed from insufficient and not sufficiently serious regulation. And so I think there's no question that in an Obama administration you would see more regulation than you have under a Bush administration.
Well, one last thought about John McCain's history. In 1999, he and other Republicans pushed through legislation that took away regulation that was established after the Great Depression. This was the Graham-Leach-Biley Act. It was sponsored by then-Senator Phil Graham, who became McCain's economic advisor and had to resign after Graham said America had become a nation of whiners. And, of course, John McCain was at the center of the Keating Five scandal, which caused the bailout of the savings and loans industry. Now, McCain was rebuked by Congress for intervening on the part of his friend Charles Keating. McCain went on to forge a name as a fighter of pork barrel spending. But, you know, is his past, ancient history, or does it somehow apply to how we should view John McCain now?
I would tend to put relatively little weight on the Keating Five scandal. It's part of his biography, and so it should be considered. But I would put much more weight on what each of these candidates is proposing.
Well, let's do that. Let's take a look then at what the candidates have proposed on the economy and taxes. Let's start with taxes and the Bush tax cuts, for instance. Barack Obama saying he'd repeal them for households earning more than $250,000. John McCain saying he would make the tax cuts permanent.
So there are two ways I think we should look at taxes. One is we should think about fiscal conservatism and what each candidate would likely do to the deficit. And then the second is distributional issues. And on the fiscal conservatism issue, the mere fact that it's called fiscal conservatism, I think, makes it seem connected to Republicans. But it hasn't been lately. If you think about the last four presidents we had, I think it's fair to call two of them fiscal conservatives, Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush, both of whom brought the deficit down, both of whom raised taxes to do it, and two presidents whom cannot fairly be called fiscal conservatives, Reagan and President George W. Bush, both of whom increased the deficit significantly. And in many ways, Obama and McCain appear to fit that pattern. Obama, based on what he's proposed, seems much more serious about the deficit than McCain. Obama has spelled out specific tax increases that he would use to keep the deficit under control. McCain, to do so, relies on really vague promises of spending cuts. And the history of vague promises of spending cuts is really bad. When people come in saying they're going to cut the budget by getting rid of waste, fraud, and abuse, they often don't end up doing it, because what is waste to me is an important program to you, and it involves a big fight, and if you don't have a mandate to cut it, it ends up being hard to cut. So I would clearly give Obama better marks in terms of fiscal conservatism.
Well, and what are you hearing specifically, if anything, from Barack Obama?
Obama's identified a few programs that are essentially corporate benefits that he would get rid of. He's also said that he's going to wind down the war in Iraq more quickly than McCain, which would lead to some additional money available to the government.
Has he also said that he would raise taxes on corporations?
That gets a little bit tricky, but on net, yes. When you talk about the kind of loopholes and the benefits he's talking about getting rid of for corporations, at the end of the day, it will raise corporate taxes. So, yes.
Finishing out the corporate tax look, John McCain says he wants to cut the corporate tax rate by 10%. He said that America has the second highest corporate tax rate in the world, and it's a less friendly place for companies to do business. But is that idea of lowering taxes for corporations who have not been seen to be all that responsible in the last couple of weeks, is that going to fly?
The corporate tax system is a mess. It's terrible, although the problem isn't that corporate taxes in this country are so high. The problem is that we sort of have the worst of both worlds. We have a high corporate tax rate, and we have enormous loopholes, so many companies can simply get out of paying taxes. So I don't think there's any question we need to reform the corporate tax system. But the main problem actually isn't the level, it's the system. before we leave Texas, I think the one other thing to add is that another difference between McCain and Obama is what they would do for families who make less than $250,000, who, of course, are the great majority of families. Mm-hmm. Obama would actually cut taxes for those families significantly more than McCain. And to me, that's arguably one of the central political failures of the Obama campaign so far, that that fact is so surprising to people. And the Obama campaign just sort of hasn't managed to get the word out on it.
Well, and you say they should get the word out on it, and yet when he did on the Bill in the Bill O'Reilly interview, he was excoriated. Obama talked about this pledge that you speak of to cut taxes for 95% of Americans while raising taxes for a smaller fraction who, as you said, earn more than $250,000. Bill O'Reilly called that class warfare and socialism, and others came out to say it's using the tax system to redistribute wealth. So in trying to get it out, he got pushback from the right.
Yeah, and you will get pushback on that. I mean, there's a fair debate about whether we should raise tax rates on the wealthy to fund tax cuts for everyone else. The argument for doing that is that the wealthy have, A, had their tax rates cut far more than anyone else over the last generation, and, B, because of economic trends and other things, have done far better than everyone else pre-tax. So there's a fairness argument to doing it, but it's a fair debate. What I would say is that given that the Obama campaign has decided to do this, and Obama told me that it's not just an economic strategy, it's a political strategy, it seems to me that even if they're going to get pushback, they want to get the message out. And the fact that they haven't quite done it yet, I still chalk up as a mistake for them.
And again, where would Obama make up for those taxes that he plans to cut for the 95% of Americans making less than $250,000 with the huge deficit? How is he going to offset that?
That's a big issue because he's not just cutting taxes. He's also talking about spending significantly more on health care reform, for example, than McCain. And the reason why he still ends up on net more fiscally conservative than McCain, there are a few reasons. One, McCain's tax cuts on upper-income families are enormous. I mean, it's a couple $100,000 a year for wealthy families.
I was going to say, do an equation for us.
Well, if we're talking about a typical family sort of at the very top of the income distribution, making $6-8 million a year, McCain would keep all the Bush tax cuts for that family and then give them another roughly $200,000 a year. Obama would get rid of the Bush tax cuts for that family, which is about $500,000 a year, and then add maybe another $300,000 a year in new taxes.
So Obama would take away $800,000 from a family making $7 million, and McCain would give $200,000 to a family?
That's exactly right. And that's the answer to your previous question. How does Obama end up looking like a fiscal conservative relative to McCain? And the answer has a number of parts to it. But one of the parts is the Bush tax cuts were big. And by taking them away, you actually end up with a sizable pot of money. And then you put on top of that some of the spending cuts that Obama's talked about. You put on top of that a faster wind down in Iraq. And you end up with a picture in which even though Obama is cutting taxes for most people more than McCain, he still on net is doing less to add to the deficit than McCain.
Okay. Well, back with David Leonhardt in 1 minute, here and now. Stay with us. We're speaking with David Leonhardt of the New York Times about the economic plans of Senators Barack Obama and John McCain. And to review, we've been talking about taxes, and Senator John McCain wants to make the Bush tax cuts permanent. And David, as you just illustrated, that would give a lot of money to very, very wealthy families, certainly earning way above $250,000. But on the other hand, Barack Obama would roll back the Bush tax cuts for families making more than $250,000 a year and give tax cuts to middle-class families, as you've said. But what else do you think we should know about the McCain and Obama economic plans?
Well, the most uncertain part of their agendas, but in many ways the most important and even the most exciting, are their ideas for getting the economy functioning better. And how do we get the American economy growing more quickly? How do we get it creating more jobs? And they've both talked about this, and they also both have some proposals on it, which I find quite interesting.
Well, McCain says he wants to make an unemployment insurance program for retraining and helping workers. Obama wants to fight for fair trade to support American jobs. I mean, and I think both have spoken of green jobs. But tell us more about what, you know, you like in the plans.
I like that wage insurance idea that McCain has. I think one of the problems with the last generation in this country is we've done a really bad job of compensating the economy's losers. we've done a really bad job of saying to people, you know what, these economic changes on net are good for our country, but we understand there's some people for whom they're very bad, and we're going to take some of our gains and we're going to compensate those people. Wage insurance essentially does that. It essentially says, look, if you lose your $20 an hour job and you can't find another, we're going to help you out a little bit. I think the most exciting part of Obama's plans in this realm are the idea that the government should play a more active role in investing in the economy. If you think about some of the most important parts of the American economy, the internet, the interstate highway system, our fabulous biomedical and healthcare sector, the fact that we dominate so many parts of the healthcare and medical care industry in the world, so many of those started with government investments. And Obama's really quite interested in having the government do more of that, which I think is particularly important after an administration, the current administration, that has really underfunded science.
David Leonhardt, columnist for The New York Times. Anything else? One last thing you want to throw out about the candidates' economic plans?
The only thing I'd throw out is I expect the economy will feel even worse when the next president takes office, because there's often a lag between how the economy feels and how it's doing. And so I think January 20th, 2009, no matter who is president, it is overwhelmingly likely that the economy will be dominating the agenda.
And it will be squarely in their lap.
Yes.
David, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we began our look at the candidates' plans through the prism of the Wall Street crisis, and here's a story related to that. The next move for the trillion-dollar insurance giant AIG might be to sell off some of its assets after the government bailout this week. The company has about 240 businesses and could quickly raise up to $35 billion by selling some side businesses, like a $10 billion aircraft leasing company or a $15 billion asset management firm or a $2 billion transatlantic reinsurance business. But what about some of the smaller holdings? That's what they're wondering up in Stowe, Vermont, home to the Stowe Mountain Resort, which is not at all small to them. AIG owns that resort, and residents are wondering if it's going to change hands. Dick Marin is chair of the Board of Selectmen there in Stowe and owner of the Town and Country Inn. So, Dick, what are people on the street saying?
Obviously, our local newspaper came out today. There's a good deal of speculation about what might happen to the resort. We know that the AIG will have to liquidate or sell some of its assets. But as part of a trillion-dollar company, the assets in Stowe are relatively small.
But big business for the region. The Boston Globe, a little south of you, the headline today is AIG sneezes, ski town gets a cold. You know, and we know that the resort is in the middle of a $400 million project to improve ski lifts and hotels and some of the condominiums there on the mountain. So, you know, are you concerned? Are people concerned? That's a lot of work. That's a lot of jobs for people if a new owner comes in and stops it.
Right. Well, I would have to think that if a new owner came in that they would want to continue the development that's going on, because the hotel is probably about 80% complete. The ski area is in really first-class condition, the best it's been since I've lived here. Of course, I think Stowe is probably the number one ski area in New England.
Did I mention that you were chair of the Stowe Select Board?
Well,
and obviously proud, you know, of Stowe.
Right.
But I mean, I guess the point is, too, that maybe in some ways, as an asset of AIG, you're a little bit luckier, because it's not likely that, as you said, someone's going to close. I mean, the mountain's going to stay. The snow's going to stay.
Well, exactly. Yeah. I mean, when you have real estate development, when you have hotels, and it's not like a manufacturing company that can just pick up
right.
and go someplace else.
But we understand, too, that people in town with this close affiliation with the resort and AIG have already been suffering.
Well, there are some people in town who are significant holders of AIG stock, and those folks have had their net worth diminished dramatically. I'm not going to mention any names, but
sure.
there are people who have retired from AIG who are top leaders in AIG, and they live in our community. And those folks have supported a lot of activities in the community through their foundation.
Well, so, I mean, are people concerned that, you know, maybe not a big blow to the town, but a trickling effect?
Well, yeah, there's definitely going to be an effect on the community and on the state of Vermont, actually, because some of those folks are very generous, have foundations that are very generous, provide scholarships to our local school kids, and Vermont State Colleges has received money from AIG stock, so there's effects here and there throughout the state.
Well, and we are thinking that that's probably being repeated across the country.
I would would think it is. I mean, these bonds were rated AA or whatever last week, and then all of a sudden they're downgraded. You know, the same thing is true with Lehman Brothers. Highly rated bonds, and now they're worse than junk.
Yeah. Does that make you a little bit, I mean, you feel, I can hear that you feel for the people that have lost their shirts, but does it also make you a little angry?
I'm not angry. I don't know how to be angry about it. It's just the way the markets work, and I think that the company would have been better off if the government had given them a loan rather than essentially taking them over. I don't think that's the business of government.
Well, and the government has said in response to that they couldn't afford to wait and see because AIG is tied to so many different things.
That's true. Yeah. That's absolutely true. But instead of taking them over, and the loan that they have is at a very high rate of interest. As a business person, I wouldn't want to pay the rate of interest that they're paying on these loans.
Well, Dick Merritt, again, chair of the Stowe Select Board, home of the Stowe Mountain Resort and all the skiing that's there. Thanks for speaking to us about this, and best to you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, a filmmaker tells the story of her childhood friend who vanished more than 30 years ago. That's tomorrow. And still ahead today, more and more states are setting up systems to allow voters to vote early, not often. Back after the news, Here and Now. Tomorrow is Election Day in the battleground state of Virginia. Well, sort of. It's when early voting starts, which means people can show up in person at designated sites and vote. And Virginia isn't alone. Several more states follow suit next week, including Iowa, another real battleground state. Well, in some states, those early votes count for more than 50% of the electorate. For the candidates, that does make every day from now on Election Day. Paul Gronke is professor of political science at Reed College in Portland, Oregon, and director of the Early Voting Information Center there. And professor, let's back up and remind ourselves, there's always been the traditional absentee voting, an absentee ballot for the housebound or people living overseas or the military serving overseas and even college students.
Correct. We started absentee balloting actually during the Civil War. But we really accelerated absentee balloting for the military around World War II, and then since then have made it much more accessible.
And in that case, for an absentee ballot, you have to apply in advance and give a reason. But now, in addition to absentee balloting, there's early voting. It's sort of somewhat different. Talk us through some of the other early voting systems.
An absentee ballot, as you describe it, is what we understand to be conventional absentee balloting. You're away at school, you're in a hospital, you're in the military. Then states decided, why do we require an excuse at all? Let's have no excuse. Let's let people get an absentee ballot if they find it inconvenient or for whatever reason that's important to them, they're unable to make it to the polling place on Election Day.
And you have to apply for them in advance, but again, you don't have to have any excuse. You get it and you mail it in.
That's correct. A few states have instituted what they call permanent no excuse. California most prominently, where you apply and then you're permanently on a list. More states allow for permanent status if you're disabled or for whatever other reason. They don't make you reapply.
Right. We should note that in your state, in Oregon and in Washington, all voters receive their ballots in the mail. But there's also early voting in person and in-person absentee. What's the difference there and what do the states do there?
Well, in many ways, it seems like the same process, but administratively, the states do something a little bit different. Early in-person voting is very similar to voting on Election Day, but you get to show up early.
And you have no prior paperwork to do this.
That's correct. Well, you have to be registered, but again, just like on Election Day. And then what some states have called one-stop absentee voting, they call it in North Carolina. Some call it early in-person absentee, which creates confusion. But it's like the absentee process, but you do all the steps at one time. You go in, you request your absentee ballot. They give you the absentee ballot. Now, Robin, you could go home, sit in your car. I actually went out and witnessed an election in San Diego where people were coming in, and they were actually taking that absentee ballot and going out and filling it out on the dashboard of their car. So it seems like the same thing, but, you know, it's different
slightly
boxes,
different
state laws, 10,000 jurisdictions, 50 states. We really have this bewildering quilt of laws in this country.
Right. There's early voting that requires no prior paperwork, early voting that requires a little bit of prior paperwork.
Well, Robin, there's already some absentee ballots that are being mailed. Kentucky and North Carolina have already put their ballots in the mail. And as you said in the lead-in, Virginia opens its process officially this week where people can go in. North Carolina may beat Virginia to the punch.
It's just amazing. And some of the states that are doing these various forms, Texas, Arkansas, Tennessee, Florida, Alaska, Georgia. You also note that there's voting by phone in Vermont and Maine and by fax in Alaska and Montana. This is primarily for people having difficulty getting to polling places. Is there any voting yet by email?
No, not that I'm aware of, though there have been attempts to institute something like this over the Internet, really, for military voters primarily.
Well, and what are the effects of all this early voting?
It really doesn't change Election Day in a lot of ways. Some people believe that absentee ballots are not counted unless races are close. That's not true. All the ballots are always counted. Where it really changes is behind the scenes. Campaigners, people who work on the ground, knocking on doors, picking up phones, mailing literature, because they're encountering an electorate where up to 10, 15, 20% of the people they speak to have already cast their ballots.
You say as much as 10% of the electorate. I'm looking at a list of the 16 toss-up states for 2008, some of them Nevada, New Mexico, Colorado. Now, in those three states, in 2006, in Nevada, almost 50% of the electorate. In New Mexico, 61% of the electorate. And in Colorado, 54% of the electorate voted early. And we understand the Guardian is reporting that the Obama campaign, for instance, is encouraging its supporters to vote early because they're afraid that there might be long lines on Election Day, November 4th, because of Republican challenges to voter eligibility, so they don't want people to be turned away. But are campaigns pushing people to vote early?
Yes. When I said 10%, I was kind of putting myself in the position of someone who's out knocking on doors a week before the campaign. But you're right. As Election Day approaches, more and more people have already cast those ballots.
What's a profile of an early voter? Is there one?
There is. Traditionally, it's been an older voter, a voter making a little bit more money, better educated, more informed, also a voter that tends to be more partisan. Also, people we found in some scattered locations, people who face long commutes, people who have complicated job situations. Maybe they're stay-at-home moms, but they're watching a number of kids and getting to the polling place on Election Day may be complicated for them.
That's Paul Gronke, director of the Early Voting Information Center and professor of political science at Reed College in Portland, Oregon. Professor Gronke, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, early voting has aroused some passions on the campus of Ball State University in Indiana. Yesterday, the County Election Board rejected a proposal for an on-campus early voting center at Ball State. It had been backed by both Republican and Democratic students. The dissenting city official said the proposed campus center wasn't needed because there's another one a mile and a half away in Muncie. But backers of the center say Ball State is one of only two colleges in Indiana that doesn't have its own voting center. Students at Ball State are registering in droves to vote, so why not make it easier for them to vote? Well, two of those students join us on the line now. Frank Hood is president of the Student Government Association at Ball State. He pushed for the early voting center. Frank, hello.
Hello.
And Alex Carroll is one of the leaders of the College Republicans at Ball State, and he was against the early voting center. Alex, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. Hello.
And Frank, for the center, let's go to you. One writer to the Star Press newspaper says, well, why should students have a center? Give it to the elderly. You guys can walk a mile to the Muncie Center, so why do you think you need it?
Well, students are usually pretty apathetic when voting, and this election cycle has been completely different. They've actually been quite riled up about it. The problem is, usually students' schedules are pretty hectic with class and organizations and things like that, and as past elections have showed us in the county, usually the lines can be pretty long, so we were concerned about students being dissuaded from voting due to long lines.
Well, Alex, who again was against the center, other colleges in Indiana have one. The student government at Ball State was going to cover the costs. It would only be for 5 days before November 4th, not a lot of time. So why not have it?
Well, the costs were not an issue. I mean, Ball State, the administration and the student government obviously had the costs covered. Our concern was that there are better places for this. There are low-income neighborhoods, they're, out by the Muncie Mall. There are better areas where this could be placed, where it could really reach people that perhaps can't drive, perhaps can't get on a bus,
We're talking to Alex Carroll. He's a leader of the College Republicans at Ball State University, as well as Frank Hood, president of the Student Government Association at Ball State. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, Alex, I want to stay with you, though, because, again, I said you're ahead of the college Republicans there. Now, in 2006, the Republican candidate lost the Muncie mayoral race by just 9 votes. The Republicans alleged that a city council member was illegally collecting absentee ballots. You got involved in this. You went out to get affidavits, testimony from people who felt they'd been wrong, and you yourself were accused of voter intimidation. That case is still in court. So you've been deep in post-election activities. Was that part of your fear? Because we've heard it expressed by others that there may be some tampering with results at an early voting center for students.
It was. With all the controversy that came out of the 2006 election, which is still, as you said, not completely resolved, you know, I was up at 6 o'clock and headed to the courthouse to testify about that I was intimidating voters, which was ludicrous, and that, you know, that people were having their ballots tampered with. And we did think that it was part of our objection to the center, is that if it was organized properly and if it was organized early enough, that this could be avoided. But we didn't want to see people busing in voters from other, you know, areas, and fraud should be avoided at all costs.
Well, Frank, the county Republican Party chair said she was concerned in part because students might be uninformed or their votes could be bought with T-shirts and hot dogs. We hear Alex say there was concern there might be fraud. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I really think that in this election, the students are probably more informed than they have ever been, and they feel that they have a chance to make an impact on a political race, especially at the national level, which hasn't happened in Indiana in ages. So really, I don't think that they were uninformed at all. And as for being bought off by freebies, that was just, to use the word Alex just used, that was ludicrous. I mean, we aren't going to be swayed that easily. We're not, like, complete simpletons.
Well, Alex, I'm wondering, isn't it a little bit insulting to assume that there might be fraud with students or that they'd be uninformed? And I hate to, you know, that kind of language is what was applied to African Americans in the South, when the people in the South wanted to keep them, they gave them tests, impossible to pass, to keep them away from the voting booth. I mean, our system is that you register to vote, you're a citizen, you vote.
I think that's true. And uninformed voters was not as much my concern. I think Ball State students are motivated and are informed about this election, but by that same token, if students are as motivated as they were yesterday in the courtroom and if as motivated they have been on campus, 1.5 miles isn't going to keep them from early voting, let alone, you know, the polling places on campus on election day.
Well, Alex, I have one last question for you. Anecdotally, across the country, the largest number of students that are registering are Barack Obama supporters. If these were largely Republican voters who were registering for this and would be interested in early voting, would you feel differently?
I honestly have considered this point several times, and I don't believe so, because it comes down to the idea of fraud and the idea of people voting that aren't allowed to, that aren't really registered here, that, you know, it couldn't be properly organized like a regular polling place would be. I think putting a polling place 1 mile closer than it otherwise would have been isn't going to make a big difference. Absentee voting, you know, you can vote any day you want right up, you know, until they're due. And if you want to vote early, students will find a way to do so.
So, Frank, do you think there's enough excitement on the part of the students that you know that they'll walk 1.5 miles?
I really don't know if they'll walk 1.5 miles. And even if they did, that wasn't the only big issue. The early voting center on our campus would have placed an early voting center within walking distance of the largest 2 employers in the county, which was another big selling point that we were pushing. And in the primaries, there were already long, hour-long lines for people to early vote. And I actually experienced that personally because I early voted in the primaries and I had to wait over 1 hour. Plus, you know, the time to get down there, you know, waiting for a bus, getting on the bus, having it stop at all the other stops. And everyone uses the argument, oh, there's absentee balloting. Well, not everyone knows that. And not everyone comfortable with voting outside of the voting booth. I'm actually one of those people personally. I don't like absentee balloting because I like voting in a voting booth because I know it's right there. Nothing can get lost in the mail or anything like that.
Frank Hood, president of the Student Government Association at Ball State. Alex Carroll is a leader of the College Republicans at Ball State as well. Thank you both. And will you both be voting on Election Day?
I actually am voting absentee. I have my ballot ready to go. So,
and I hopefully will be a poll inspector, so I will be voting early if possible.
I want to thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, coming up, reflections on Federico Fellini, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we have this update on a story we've been following. Motorists are again streaming across the new I-35W bridge in Minneapolis, just a little more than a year after the old one collapsed into the Mississippi River, killing 13. The National Transportation Safety Board has scheduled a hearing in November to discuss its investigation into what caused that old bridge to collapse. But meanwhile, the new $234 billion bridge is called a smart bridge, with hundreds of embedded sensors that will generate a record of how it's handling the strains of traffic and Minnesota's harsh climate. Those sensors collect data that will be monitored at an area university and will help identify small problems before they become big ones. You might remember when we were in Minnesota for the Republican National Convention, we took the weekend tour of the bridge construction to see the fascinating modern technology. The concrete bridge is built with redundant systems, so if one part fails, it won't lead to a disaster. Well, hundreds of residents and tourists have been taking this tour all summer to see the advanced construction or overcome their fear. Peter Sanderson of Flatiron Construction's project manager for the new bridge conducted our tour.
It helps the public understand what's going on and will increase their confidence in what we've built.
Do you feel pressure to get it right?
Absolutely. We've had excruciating pressure to get it right. I've never been involved in anything that has even close to this amount of quality control and assurance.
Well, the new I-35W bridge, one of the main arteries in the heart of Minneapolis-St. Paul, was completed on budget and more than 3 months ahead of the December 24th deadline, meaning the contractors could get a bonus of close to $27 million. Today, some of the bridge collapse survivors said they were eager to cross the new one to put the past behind them. Others need more time. Ty Vo told reporters, "No matter how safe, no matter how pretty, I'll try to find all the reasons not to go there." Well, occasionally we impose on, we beg, Here and Now jazz aficionado James Isaacs to share with us his thoughts on his favorite things. We always learn something. And today James brings us his reflections on his favorite film. It's by a man who found inspiration in the circus and in Variety, the name the Italians gave to vaudeville, and a man who first trained his eye as a cartoonist for a Roman newspaper. He's director Federico Fellini.
There was always the sound of the wind. It howled along the beach, jangled wind chimes outside a white jewel box of a house with green shutters, carried whispers from spirits known and unknown in counterpoint to the sweet hurdy-gurdy jazz or flying organ or circus marches or sweeping strings on the soundtrack. Federico Fellini would go on to create as eye-popping a gallery of images as his surrealist forebears, the painters Dali and Magritte. And one is also haunted by the sound of the films of Fellini, whose musical soulmate was the wondrous Nino Rota, who scored all of Fellini's films from 1952 until the composer's death at 68 in 1979. Has there ever been a more musical name? Nino Rota. Fellini died in 1993 at 73. Fittingly, it was on Halloween when the spirits come out to play, for Il Maestro talked freely, if not always easily, with the spirits. During a number of these encounters, especially in his masterpiece, 8 1/2, Fellini pondered the notion that there is no salvation outside the city of God. He wondered aloud to his departed parents if he'd been a good son. He agonized over whether he really had anything to say, fearing that somewhere out in the cosmos, beyond the plane of profits and losses, there would be no purity of expression after all. For Fellini, like Proust, the light was at or near the beginning of the tunnel of time. In 8 1/2, there develops one of the most glowingly beautiful extended scenes ever filmed. The director's despairing alter ego, Guido Anselmi, played with puffy weariness by the great Marcello Mastroianni, is at an opulent health spa to take the cure for a sluggish liver. But the pain runs deeper. In 8 1/2, whose original English title was going to be The Beautiful Confusion, the 43-year-old Guido is more than merely confused. He is, as Robert Johnson wrote in his timeless blues, standing at the crossroads. After considerable international success as a director, he's creatively blocked. His marriage is on shaky ground, and he's tired of the vapid, buxom, overdressed mistress parked at a nearby hotel. One evening, at the spa, Guido and his party take in an alfresco magic show. As fate would have it, the spindly magician with the wide-lens grin is an old pal from their days in Variety. Working with the magician is a blindfolded mentalist, Maya, who amuses the patrons with such parlor tricks as guessing the contents of a society matron's handbag. Invited by L'Illusionista to join the cheerless fun, Guido accepts. He will think of something specific, and Maya will try to guess what's on his mind. At first, she is utterly baffled. Then she writes on a blackboard the following three words. Asa, Nisi, Masa. Is that it? The magician asks Guido. Si. He nods morosely. Whereupon we flash back to Guido's childhood, circa 1930, when he's splashing about with his little cousins in a vat of wine grapes, then he's bathed and bundled off to bed by his adoring nannies. In the children's bedroom, there's a portrait of the severe-looking Uncle Agostino. Guido, one of his female cousins whispers in the dark. Uncle Agostino will look into the corner and we'll find the treasure. We'll be rich. When I saw 8 1/2 the first time, decades ago, I could have sworn that the eyes in the painting moved. Now I'm sure they don't. This I can tell you for certain. If one removes the last two letters of each word in asa, nisi, masa, one comes up with anima, or in Italian, soul. Soul is what Fellini's Guido is looking for in his work, first and foremost. It's what so many of us seek, and it is a most elusive quality. 8 1/2 has soul, and then some. The story, the music, the cinematography, the costumes, the sets, the performances, the faces. It is Fellini's song to himself, his divine comedy. And even if one has little patience for his egotism, if nothing else, he created what remains the most important and entertaining film about the making of a film. Now, say the magic words with me, and perhaps the eyes of the picture will move, leading us all to the treasure that is our souls. Asa nisi masa, asa nisi masa, asa nisi masa, asa nisi masa.
Asa nisi masa, asa nisi masa, asa nisi masa. Shh.